le nez sur la radio qui répète qu'il fait chaud. Tous les jours c'est pareil, faut que je me cache du soleil, il fait chaud. Faire attention au soleil, il fait chaud. Et tous les jours c'est pareil.
Hi Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So we're back for a last episode before a summer break.
Yeah, I needed a break, but it does already really feel like summer.
Yeah, yeah, just coming out of a few days here of extremely high heat in most of France, over 40 degrees in some places, especially in the south and southwest.
Yeah, and even here in Paris, you know, we've had some super high temperatures. Yeah. It hit 43 the other day in the afternoon when I was out on my bike.
Yeah, it was really hot, really hot. And two people died in France related to the heat. 300 went to the hospital for dehydration and exhaustion.
And the heat has also impacted people working, of course. Mm-hmm. Schools have been closed. Farmers were told not to work in the fields during the hottest hours to protect their health, but also to prevent the risk of fire.
Yeah, and it's unusual to have such high temperatures in June, even if it was the end of June. Energy Minister Agnès Pannier-Runacher said that this was France's hottest June since 2003. That fateful year when thousands of people died across France because of the heat.
Yeah, now the heat this year, anyway, is being linked to climate change.
Indeed, indeed. Rising CO2 levels in the atmosphere traps more heat, causes more extreme weather like this heat wave. And so we're getting a taste of what the future might hold. In order to get a sense of what it would be like to live in a world with regular extreme temperatures, an institute has created a climate room, a container on a truck that's heated to 50 degrees Celsius.
Wow, 50 degrees.
Yeah, yeah. Now, some places in the world have actually reached this temperature, and it happens regularly. France and most of Europe isn't quite there yet, but the Human Adaptation Institute, that studies how people adapt to new conditions, wants us to consider what it would be like, maybe to get us to move faster, to try to change things in order to avoid getting to the point where we might see 50 degree temperatures. Mm. The climate room has been going around France for the past several months, raising awareness, one hot person at a time. Our colleague Jeanne Richard went to check it out when it came to Marseille a few weeks ago.
Je vous conseille d'y aller en t-shirt si vous pouvez.
Véronique Casimiro, the mediator for the climate room, suggests that those going in wear only t-shirts.
Tout le monde est prêt?
Oui.
Alors on est parti.
She ushers in Martin Estivals and Emma-Louise Robins, both in their early 20s. They'd heard about this room from a friend, and they were curious to try it out.
C'est étouffant. Ça fait très chaud.
It's hot. It's stifling, says Martin. Over the next 30 minutes, they'll have to do three different tasks, 10 minutes each. The first one, walking on a treadmill at a regular pace, like they would walking to work or taking the kids to school or going shopping. Martin's already feeling the heat after just a few minutes.
On a l'impression qu'il y a plus facilement besoin de prendre de grandes respirations alors qu'on fait pas d'effort.
I feel like I need to take in more air even though I'm not making that much of an effort.
J'ai vachement chaud à la tête, mais le reste du corps pour l'instant ça va.
My head is really hot, says Emma Louise. Both of them say they're getting headaches after just 10 minutes.
Vous êtes dans la chambre depuis 10 minutes, je vous invite à changer d'atelier.
They change tasks. The next is to do games at a table to work their fine motor skills. Martin moves a loop of metal over a bar without having them touch.
Je suis pas précis pour mettre.
If they do touch, there's a beep.
Yeah. C'est pas si simple.
I'm not precise, he says. It's not easy. My hands are sweaty. I'm trembling more than I would normally. He and Emma-Louise take a water break. And it's hot.
J'ai presque l'impression de prendre un thé, une tisane.
It's like drinking tea, says Martin. The third exercise is cognitive, a set of riddles and questions to see how their brains are working in this extreme heat. Emma-Louise is cooked.
J'arrive même pas à lire la première phrase. Lisez une seule fois la liste de mots suivante.
I can't even read the first line, she says. The directions ask her to look at a list of words, then turn over the paper and recall that list. And she's having a lot of trouble.
Oh là là, c'est fou, j'arrive à rien retenir.
I can't remember anything, she says. She got 6 out of 10 right and does no better on an exercise asking her to compare two different images.
Genre là, par exemple, j'arrive pas du tout à trouver les différences dans les cubes. Pour moi, tout est pareil. Alors que d'habitude, c'est plutôt un exercice sur lequel je suis fort.
I'm usually pretty good at this kind of thing, she says. But my body is focusing on itself physically. My brain isn't working. She can't wait to get out of the room.
Je crois qu'on peut sortir, non? Ça va faire du bien de prendre l'air.
Non, je pense que...
Ah oui, c'est bon. Oh mon Dieu.
Ah, it feels good, she says. On the way out, the two test their body temperatures and heart rates, which they'd done on the way in, and they compare the two readings. Emma Louise went from 36.3 degrees to 38.4, 2 degrees hotter.
Ah, my God, c'est énorme, 38.4. J'ai quand même pris 2 degrés sur ma température intérieure.
That's huge, she says. I'm 2 degrees hotter. I have a fever. My heart rate went up. Christian Clot, the researcher behind the Human Adaptation Institute, who created the climate room, says there is a real physiological response to extreme heat.
When you are subject to intense heat, the body struggles to maintain its regular temperature of 36 to 37 degrees. Your organs work harder, your heart rate will increase, kidneys work harder. The brain slows down a bit to avoid overheating. You lose certain cognitive capacities of concentration, decision-making, calculation. So there is a cognitive, psychological, and even social degradation because the brain wants to help other people less. Being social takes a lot of energy and you become more irritable or you just want to spend less time with others. And bit by bit, your social skills break down.
He says the idea of the chamber is to give people a physical jolt to help them become aware of the need to change their habits to avoid more climate change, which will bring about extreme temperatures.
For a person to change their behavior, they must be affected sensorially and emotionally. So, to understand the climate of the future, you need to have an experience that allows you to feel it emotionally. It helps people make decisions on how they act today.
And there have been decisions. He says their follow-up surveys have shown that over 60% of participants say they will change behavior. For Emma Louise, who's originally from Paris, but now lives in Aix-en-Provence, where temperatures can get very hot, especially in the summer, the experience in the room has driven home the impacts of warming on her daily life. Even if we're aware of global warming, it's good to be confronted with the repercussions, she says. Maybe it'll help us make more of an effort to change our habits. For Martin, the experience helped make him more aware of what just a few degrees increase in temperature really feels like.
Qu'est-ce que ça veut dire 50 degrés? C'est difficile à imaginer, ben là au moins on le teste. Mais ce qui est difficile, c'est de se dire que ce serait toute une journée.
What is 50 degrees really, he says. It's hard to imagine it, but here you get to test it. What's even harder to imagine is what it would be like to have this all the time, all day, every day. That's not the same thing. And yet, high temperatures are already a reality for people around the world, increasingly in France during the summer, says Christian
Clot.
Unfortunately, we could have these temperatures in France as soon as 2050 or 2060, getting to 50 degrees for a few days and then a bit by bit for a few weeks, if we're not careful. There are predictions of 45 to 46 degrees by the 2040s and 50s, which is already huge.
Ultimately, Claude wants awareness for people to change things now to avoid hitting 50 degrees in the future, but also to adapt to the 40 plus degrees that we're seeing today.
La température la plus élevée mesurée en France aujourd'hui, c'est 46,1 degrés.
The highest temperature ever recorded in France was 46.1 degrees for a short time. Fortunately, it's still very rare, but still, we're already reaching 46 degrees. In some places like Arles or Aix-en-Provence, which do not have a cooling sea breeze, temperatures are regularly hitting 36, 37 or 38 degrees and stays hot for a while. So we're gradually seeing more frequent conditions that are problematic for human beings.
He says it will be key to look at how people adapt in places where 50 degrees is the norm, in Pakistan and Mexico. A major thing will be not working during the heat of the day.
We will have to work a lot more in the mornings and maybe in the evenings. And that means everyone must change. It's not just those who work outside. Because if you have a jackhammer in the streets at 4 a.m., it wakes everyone up. So the whole of society will have to accept new work hours.
He says people will have to embrace things like the mid-afternoon nap, for example. His institute has proposals, standard ones for adapting and mitigating, like insulating homes, not using too much energy to heat in the winter or cool in the summer. But Clou says that there's also a bigger question connected to time and the speed.
On a tendance à vouloir accélérer en permanence.
We have a tendency to want to go faster all the time. For example, when you order something, you want it in 24 hours. If we just accepted deliveries in 3 to 4 days, we would already hugely reduce our carbon footprint. Every time we accelerate, we emit more CO2.
And speed impacts the human body too.
If you want to think faster, your brain heats up faster. So really, speed is a major factor in climate change.
So he says we need to slow down. Mm-hmm. I'm all in favor of that.
Sure, yeah, slow down to reduce emissions. But the heat will force us to slow down anyway, as the climate room shows. And also, as we just experienced the last few days in this very hot weather, which wasn't even close to 50 degrees.
Dernier métro de ce merdier rétro. Dernière rame d'un drôle de drame.
So Allison, this is the sound of the Paris Metro. I don't actually hear it that often. I don't take it very much because I'm mostly on my bike.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
But the metro is the main form of transportation for Parisians, mm-hmm. and it turns 125 years old this month.
Yeah, the very first line was inaugurated on the 19th of July, 1900. It connected Porte Maillot in the northwest of the city with Porte de Vincennes in the east, roughly today's Line 1. It was intended to connect the main sites of the 1900 World's Fair. And it was the first of 6 lines that were completed by the 1920s.
Now, today, the metro is a symbol of Paris, right? Mm. It's a very dense system. It's got unique architecture. You've got those iconic Art Nouveau entrances, you know, the pale green ones,
yeah.
with those wrought iron signs saying Metropolitan.
Yeah, there's a few left even mm-hmm. today. But it took a while to get us to this metro. The idea of a rail system linking the city was floated as of the mid-1800s, before any other city had a subway. At that point, transit in Paris was these omnibus lines with fixed routes and schedules, but they were out on the streets and traffic was getting terrible. The first idea was a surface cable car system, but the idea of an underground was attractive in order to avoid accidents and traffic above ground.
Yeah, the London Tube had already opened in 1863, so there was an example for Paris to follow.
Yeah, London got there first because decision-making in Paris was stalled by political disagreements mm-hmm. over who
Unusual.
Got to... It's very true. Never happens. There were disagreements over who got to control the project. You know, the city wanted transport for locals, the state, which owned the mainline rail system, they just wanted tracks to access Paris. Congestion on the streets continued to get worse and worse until finally a project was given the green light in 1890. So a system of lines crossing the city, sort of following the large boulevards.
But there was debate about where those lines should be.
Mm.
Some people were against underground trains. They thought that humans didn't belong underground.
Yeah, yeah, that was seen as the realm of the dead.
Yeah, the catacombs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there were those who were against elevated lines.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the writer Victor Hugo, he was among those that vehemently opposed elevated trains and the viaducts that they needed to get around the city. He thought that would make Paris ugly.
Mm.
And another writer, Guy de Maupassant, who was a vocal opponent of the building of the Eiffel Tower for the same reasons, well, he weighed into the debate as well.
Sure, yeah. And anyway, the final plan, which was mostly underground, was adopted in 1886. It was elaborated by the engineer Fulgence Bienvenu. The plan was to serve only the city proper of Paris, so not to allow mainline trains to use the tracks or even have any connections with the suburbs. So in order to do this, the trains and tunnels were made to be too narrow for the mainline trains. This was kind of like a secretive project by the city.
Mm.
And the metros were also going to run on the right, so they couldn't connect with existing suburban trains, which ran on the left. Construction began in November of 1898. Bienvenu had come up with this cut-and-cover method of building tunnels, which went faster than drilling underground and also avoided major accidents. There's some amazing pictures of these huge trenches with massive structures over them, and they were then paved over and the streets went back to normal. The first line with only 8 stations then was open on July 19th, 1900. This woman, Madame Barral, says that she was one of the first to take the line with a group of friends from Hôtel de Ville, City Hall, in the middle of Paris, towards the Bois de Vincennes in the east of the city.
En descendant dans ces voûtes, qui étaient glaciales, toutes sombres, Nous n'étions pas très fiers.
Going down underground, the arches were freezing, she said. Everything was dark. We were intimidated. The platforms were dark. There wasn't much light. She and her friends were the only ones in the train car, she said.
Bit of a ghost train.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't sound very pleasant. And then she said when they got out, their clothes smelled terrible of tar and the cleaning products.
Yeah, not a very auspicious beginning. No. Although Metro is still kind of smelly.
Yeah, and I would say some might say her description is still pretty apt today.
Yeah, for some of the lines, anyway.
For some of the lines, anyway. From there, the system expanded. The first line to cross the river Seine opened in January 1910, that today is the line 4 of the metro. It had to close a few days later when the Seine flooded, that once-in-a-century occurrence.
A bit of bad luck.
Bit of bad luck, indeed. There was also competition. In addition to this first network, there was another company that got a contract to build three other lines, which used trains that were compatible with both the original metro as well as mainline trains. That company eventually went bankrupt, and the lines were merged into the bigger system, today part of lines 8, 10, 12, and 13. In the 1930s, the system began to expand beyond Paris, so the first line to go beyond the city limits was line 9 to Boulogne-Billancourt. It opened in February of 1934.
Today, the system is 245 kilometers long. Mm-hmm. It's got 321 stations on 16 lines, so 1 to 14, and then with line 3 and 7 having a bis version. Mm-hmm. So mostly the lines are underground. Three of them are now automated, and line 14 now goes through to Orly Airport. What a godsend that is.
For sure. It does change things. About 4 million people take the metro each day, which is impressive. And Châtelet-Les Halles, with 5 metro and 3 RER commuter lines, is one of the world's largest and busiest stations. There are plans to further extend some lines, and a massive expansion program known as the Grand Paris Express is underway. 4 new ring lines, 15 through 18, will ring the Île-de-France region, keeping us all connected.
So, Sarah, I've been struggling of late to find eggs in my local supermarket. Just last Friday, seriously, there were none. Oh. Empty shelves.
Empty shelves.
Have you noticed the same thing?
To be fair, I actually get my eggs directly from a farmer.
Okay.
So supply depends on how the chickens are feeling any given week. But I have to say, I have sort of noticed that there were gaps in the grocery store.
Yeah, well, it's not just a perception. France is Europe's biggest egg producer. We're talking 15 billion eggs a year.
Whoa.
And yet there are these gaps.
All right. So France produces all these eggs. What's going on?
Well, eggs are basically a victim of their own success.
Ah.
French people are now eating more than ever, 240 per person per year. That's a 20-year record. So that's a combination of shelled eggs and eggs that are used in processed foods. Huh? According to the CNPO, that's the National Committee for Egg Promotion, demand has gone up by between 4 and 5% a year for the last 2 years, but production levels have stayed the same, so demand is outpacing supply.
Okay, so what's with this love affair with eggs? Is it about the protein? I know there's this growing obsession with protein these days in like health circles.
Yeah, there is. And eggs are a cheap source of protein. Mm. Your average egg costs around 25 cents. Alice Richard, who is head of the CNPO, says the price weighs in when people are struggling with the rising cost of living.
L'œuf, c'est la protéine animale finalement la moins chère.
Eggs are the cheapest source of animal protein. So naturally, people turned to them when prices were rising across the board. And now those habits have kind of stuck. Plus, eggs are simple, convenient, and quick to cook. That really fits with how people eat today. They don't take as much time. And then there's also the health angle. For a long time, people thought that eggs were bad because of cholesterol. But now doctors have changed their tune. So they've made a bit of a comeback as a good-for-you food.
So, Alison, there have been big egg shortages in the United States. After bird flu devastated egg farms, prices tripled. Mm. I mean, there were like quotas in the grocery stores to buy eggs. It was pretty crazy. Is something similar happening in France?
Yeah. Richard said that when the US was at the peak of its shortages, the images did cause a bit of panic buying and stockpiling here in France. But contrary to the US, France hasn't had the same disease problem with bird flu.
Cette année, on a eu uniquement deux foyers de grippe aviaire en 2024-2025.
This year, we've only had two cases, and they were in relatively small farms, so production hasn't really been affected. That's thanks to vaccination. Ducks are the main spreaders of bird flu, and we vaccinated all of the ducks in France. We started vaccinating 2 years ago, and it's really helped to prevent outbreaks.
Yeah, France has actually been on the forefront of vaccination, especially with its large flocks of ducks for foie gras. Anyway, in terms of eggs, what is France doing to fill the gap between the supply and demand?
Well, it's ended up importing eggs, as many as 20%, and some of them are from Ukraine. They've entered the EU market via Hungary and Poland, which have both been hard hit by bird flu. And then, well, it's just a short flight or ride to France. Richard says this is definitely not the way forward. The eggs are unfair competition for the French market because they're cheaper, because Ukraine doesn't have the same regulations either in terms of hygiene or animal welfare.
In France, 75% of our eggs are either free range from hens in barns with the red label standard or organic. Only 25% are from hens kept in cages. But in Ukraine, almost all hens are raised either in cages or kept inside, and their cage norms are different. And the health and safety standards aren't the same as in France, especially around things like salmonella. France has very strict rules about that. Ukraine doesn't.
So what's the solution? What's her group proposing?
Well, they've launched a €300 million plan to build 300 new hen houses by 2030, and they want France's strict regulations on setting up farms to be loosened.
Our main goal is to be able to meet the rising demand through French eggs. That means increasing production. But building new farms takes time, so we want to make it easier for farmers to start or expand their farms, reduce red tape so people can renovate, expand, or get into egg farming more easily.
Now, the average size of these new farms will be around 30,000 hens, though some will obviously be a lot bigger. And this is a source of controversy. One existing poultry farm, if you can call it a farm, it's just outside Paris, it's already got 900,000 hens. Get your head around that. And it's just received the green light from local authorities to expand to 1.2 million birds. And this was despite a lot of opposition from some local people and especially animal rights groups.
Farmers are trying to improve their production and make profits at the end of the day, which is understandable from their point of view, but it doesn't fit with animal needs.
That's Cyril Ernst from Anima, a group that campaigns specifically against keeping hens in cages. Now, he's not against new farms per se, but he says they've got to respect animal welfare.
New farms that are being built in France, especially hen farms, should meet high animal welfare standards, or else they will be obsolete in 15 years when none will progress again. So we support this transition and also the public funding, as long as it's for higher welfare farms. But if we are talking about farm extensions that are simply expanding traditional systems or even making it worse because building farms at very large scales with 1 million hens, for example, this is not a solution.
So, Sarah, it's important to know that EU legislation that was passed in 2012 means that cages are now what they call enriched compared to those awful battery hen types that we had years ago. So it means that hens have a little bit more space. They have a bar to perch on and some tiny enrichments, but fundamentally they're still being kept in cages. At the same time, since 2018 in France, cages have been banned in new constructions. However, they can still be used in existing farms or in renovated ones. Now, about 12 million hens are currently raised in these enriched cages, and most of those eggs are used in processed foods. About 20% of whole eggs sold in supermarkets are also cage eggs. They're often sold on those big cardboard trays of around 30, and of course, they're the cheapest. Now, egg farmers are increasingly moving towards free-range alternatives, and Ernst says they have to be encouraged, even if they're trying to keep their production costs down.
Yes, price is important, and that's why we're not against funding this transition, because maybe new farms need to be built. But the question is, what type of farms are we heading towards and investing in? And is it a sound investment that we are building huge farms with minimalistic welfare? Of course not. So we need to really have a debate. and involve animal welfare organizations, scientists, about what's the best for the next, let's say, 30 years for animals and also for consumers. What we're doing to animals is not something that is a secondary question in society. It becomes more and more in the forefront of what people think.
Animal welfare groups are also concerned about rolling back environmental checks, which are currently imposed on farms with more than 40,000 hens. To boost production and encourage more farmers, the CPAO is pushing for a reduction in red tape, which it says is far more constraining in France than in other EU countries. And that, again, is leading to unfair competition.
Yeah, this unfair competition sounds familiar. Farmers across industries are saying the same thing, also wanting looser environmental standards.
Yeah, so they want the environmental review threshold to be raised from the current 40,000 to 60,000 hens and simpler procedures across the board. Nicole Lepé, she's an MP and also a farmer. She recently laid out the problem to the agriculture minister during a discussion in Parliament.
Les éleveurs sont prêts à répondre à cette demande croissante, mais ils se heurtent.
Farmers are ready to meet the growing demand, but they're coming up against obstacles, she says. The first is the terrain. Building projects, even those that comply with standards and are open air, are being slowed down, contested, or even blocked.
A reference there to animal rights activists, right? Mm. She's not particularly happy with them.
No.
What did the agriculture minister have to say?
Well, Anne Genevard has been very supportive of the CNPO project to build the new hen houses, saying that it is within reach, providing they are allowed.
Alors déjà, faut convaincre nos concitoyens que c'est utile d'avoir des poulaillers.
We need to convince our fellow citizens that hen houses are useful to produce both eggs and chickens to satisfy growing consumption, she says. We need to simplify procedures. They're too complicated. That is the purpose of the bill, aimed at lifting the constraints on agriculture so as not to discourage people with their projects.
Ah, she's referring there to this general agriculture bill currently making its way through the parliament. Mm-hmm. It's controversial, right, because it's focused on simplifying and loosening environmental protection. So as much of agriculture these days, there's this tension, right, between what farmers want and then what animal welfare and environmental advocates want.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. And yet there is also some consensus on this particular issue. The CNPO wants more harmonised regulation on egg production at the EU level. And Ernst, with his association, wants France to support a full ban on cages across the EU, which is little by little in the pipeline. He reckons that the two groups' interests coincide.
They are partners, respectful actors, and our aim is to ban cages with them because they are here. Our interests uniquely aligned, I think, in this case, because French farmers are transitioning to cage-free systems at the moment, and it's our interest that at the EU level it's being done the same.
So that's it for Spotlight on France. It's a production of Radio France International, and this episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
And it's our last episode until the fall. We're taking a summer break. In the meantime, you can listen to past shows on rfienglish.com or here on your podcast app, wherever you're listening to us.
And if you want to send us a note, use your holidays to do just that. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
We'd love to hear from you. And you can find photos and videos of the stories we've covered on our Instagram page, Spotlight on France. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah.